Okay, let's unpack this. Today, we're diving deep, really deep, into quantum physics. You've given us some really fascinating sources here. We've got foundational experiments, some pretty mind-bending theories, and even real-world tech stuff.
Yeah, the applications are quite something.
So our mission, really, is to wade through all this complexity and pull out some clear, maybe surprising insights for you, kind of help you see the universe maybe a bit differently.
Absolutely. And what's so intriguing, I think, is how quantum physics just completely flips our everyday intuition on its head. It shows us a universe working by totally different rules at the tiniest scales. We'll look at the core ideas, waves, particles, probability, try and connect those dots for you.
Definitely. We should start where it all kind of kicked off, right? With the experiments that basically broke classical physics.
Good starting point.
Davison and Germer, for instance, their experiment was just, well, groundbreaking. It really showed the wave properties of matter.
With electrons.
Exactly. Electrons, things we absolutely thought were just tiny particles, suddenly acting like waves. And that led straight to figuring out the de Broglie wavelength.
It was a huge shift. Suddenly, these subatomic things weren't just little billiard balls anymore. And it wasn't totally out of the blue, I guess. There was earlier work, like Bragg's stuff with X-rays.
Oh, right, Bragg and the Compton wavelength. Similar wave ideas there, too.
Exactly. So physicists really had to ditch the simple, is it a wave or are a particle kind of
And
thinking?
embrace something much weirder.
Pretty much. This idea that maybe it's both or neither.
Which brings us straight to that core quantum idea, complementarity, right?
Precisely, the principle of complementarity. It basically says things like electrons can show wave or particle traits.
But not both at the exact same time. It depends how you look, how you measure.
Exactly. You measure it one way, it looks like a particle. Measure it another way, it looks like a wave. You can't pin down both aspects simultaneously. It's fundamentally slippery.
Mind-bending, truly. And that slipperiness, that dual nature, it needed a whole new way to describe it mathematically.
Which is where Schrödinger and his famous equations step in.
Yes, the Schrödinger equation.
It gives us the wave function, the mathematical description of a quantum state. But, and this is key, it's not describing a physical wave like in water.
Right, it's a wave of probability.
Exactly, probability waves. And Max Born, he really nailed the interpretation later.
The probabilistic interpretation of the wave function.
He showed that if you square the amplitude of this wave function, what you get is the probability density.
Meaning the likelihood of finding the particle right there at that spot.
Precisely, like finding the electron density in an atom, it's a complete departure from classical physics where you could, in theory, know exactly where something is.
So it's inherently fuzzy.
Deeply fuzzy. And it's not just fuzziness because we don't know enough, like flipping a coin. That's probability from ignorance.
Okay.
This is quantum probability, this fundamental baked into reality.
Wow. And that leads to some really strange effects, doesn't it? Like particles getting through barriers.
The tunnel effect, yes. Even if a particle doesn't technically have enough energy to climb over a potential energy barrier,
It can just sort of pop through to the other side.
it has a non-zero probability of being found on the other side. It effectively tunnels through. It's not intuitive at all.
But it's real. We use it, right? That scanning, tunneling microscope.
Exactly. That technology directly relies on the tunnel effect to see individual atoms. It's amazing. It's all about that probability of finding a particle where classical physics says it absolutely shouldn't be.
Okay, so probability is fundamental. What else is core to this quantum weirdness?
Well, if probability wasn't enough, there's Heisenberg's uncertainty principle.
Ah, the big one. You can't know everything perfectly.
That's the gist. You can't simultaneously know both the exact position and the exact momentum of a particle with perfect
The
accuracy,
more you nail down one.
the fuzzier the other one gets. And crucially, this isn't because our measuring tools are bad. No, it's a fundamental limit. It's built into how the universe works, tied to Planck's reduced constant. It's just how things are.
So reality itself has limits on what can be known. That's profound.
It is. And it ties into other ideas like superposition.
Where a particle can be in multiple states at once.
Sort of, yeah. It exists in a combination of all its possible quantum states until you measure it, then it kind of picks one. Before the measurement, it's like it's everywhere and nowhere specific.
Okay, this is where my brain starts to hurt a little. Measurement changes things.
That's one way to think about it, yeah. observation seems to play a really active role, which is deeply strange.
And the classic illustration of this is the double slit experiment, but with electrons this time.
The very same. It's maybe the most elegant demonstration of quantum mystery. You fire electrons, one by one, at a barrier with two slits.
And if you don't watch which slit they go through.
They act like waves. They interfere with themselves, creating a pattern on the screen behind like ripples in water would, as if each electron somehow went through both slits.
Which is nuts for a particle. But if you put a detector there to see which slit it uses.
Boom. The interference pattern vanishes. The electrons behave like well-behaved particles going through one slit or the other.
It's like they know. They know they're being watched.
It certainly feels that way. It forced physicists to develop interpretations like the Copenhagen interpretation.
Okay, what's the core idea there?
Broadly, it says a quantum system stays in that fuzzy superposition of states until an active measurement or observation collapses the wave function into one definite outcome.
And that's where Schrödinger's poor cat comes in.
Exactly. The famous Schrödinger's cat thought experiment. It's designed to show how weird this idea is when scaled up. You imagine a cat in a box whose fate depends on a random quantum event, like radioactive decay.
So according to Copenhagen, until you open the box and look.
The cat is neither definitively alive nor definitively dead. It's in a superposition of both states, alive and dead simultaneously.
Which is just bizarre. It really highlights the role of the observer or the measurement.
It does. It pushes against our classical notion of an objective reality existing independently of observation. Some even talked about needing a three-value logic, true, false, and undecided.
So does this apply to everything? Am I in a superposition until someone looks at me?
Huh. Thankfully, no. That's where the correspondence principle comes in handy.
Okay, what's that?
It basically says that as quantum systems get bigger and more complex, involving many particles or high energy levels, their behavior starts to look more and more like classical physics predicts.
So quantum rules apply at the micro level, but classical rules emerge at our macro level. Phew.
Exactly. There's a bridge between the two worlds. Quantum mechanics smoothly transitions into classical mechanics where appropriate.
Okay, good. So moving from the weirdness to something more structural. Quantum mechanics is also the foundation for understanding atoms, right?
Absolutely fundamental. Take the simplest atom, hydrogen. Quantum mechanics tells us that the electron can't just orbit the nucleus anywhere it likes.
Its orbits are quantized.
Precisely. Only specific, discrete energy levels are allowed, like steps on a ladder, not a smooth ramp.
And we describe the electron state using those quantum numbers.
That's right. A set of four numbers that act like the electron's unique quantum address.
Okay, walk me through them. There's the principal quantum number.
That basically tells you the energy level, the electron shell. Higher N means higher energy, further from the nucleus on average.
Then the orbital quantum number.
Correct. That determines the shape of the electron's orbital, like spherical, dumbbell shape, etc., and it quantizes the electron's angular momentum.
Angular momentum is quantized too. Okay.
What's next? The magnetic quantum number, sub L. This specifies the orientation of that orbital shape in space when you apply a magnetic field. It tells you about the Z component of the angular momentum.
Got it. And the last one, spin.
The spin quantum number, my subs, this describes an intrinsic angular momentum of the electron itself, almost like it's spinning, though that's just an analogy.
And its spin is also quantized, up or down.
Essentially, yeah. The Z component of its spin angular momentum has specific quantized values. This idea is strongly linked to Wolfgang Pauli.
So these four numbers define everything about an electron state in an atom.
It's complete quantum state, yes. And they're not just theoretical. They explain real observable effects, like the Zeeman effect.
Ah, right. What happens there?
If you put an atom in a magnetic field, those energy levels we talked about actually split into several slightly different sublevels.
Why?
Because the electron's angular momentum makes it act like a tiny magnet, and its magnetic potential energy changes depending on its orientation relative to the external field. The splitting confirms these quantized states.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, what about atoms with lots of electrons, not just simple hydrogen?
Good question. Things get more complex, obviously, but the same principles apply. We talk about hydrogen-like atoms sometimes as models, but the key rule for multi-electron atoms is the Pauli exclusion principle.
Another one from Pauli. What does this one exclude?
It excludes the possibility of any two electrons in the same atom having the exact same set of all four quantum numbers.
So no two electrons can share the same quantum address.
Exactly. Think of it like seats in a theater. Once an electron occupies a specific state, defined by NLMLMS, no other electron can have that exact same state.
And that principle is huge, right? It dictates how electrons fill up the available energy levels.
Absolutely massive. It forces electrons to occupy progressively higher energy levels and different orbital shapes. It's the fundamental reason we have distinct electron configurations for different atoms.
Which explains the periodic table.
The entire structure of the periodic table of elements. Why elements in the same column have similar chemical properties? It's because they have similar outer electron configurations, all thanks to Pauli exclusion. It's the bedrock of chemistry, really.
Wow. From quantum numbers to the whole periodic table.
Okay.
And these electron energy levels, they're also key to how atoms interact with light.
Definitely. Photon emission and absorption, it's all about electrons jumping between these allowed quantized energy levels.
Absorbing a photon jumps it up. Emitting one lets it drop down.
Precisely. And the energy of the photon has to exactly match the energy difference between the levels. That's why atoms have specific spectral lines. They only absorb or emit very particular colors or energies of light.
We see this in things like X-rays too, right? Bremsstrahlung radiation.
Yeah, bremsstrahlung is one way X-rays are produced when electrons rapidly decelerate. But you also get characteristic X-rays when, say, an incoming high-energy electron knocks out an inner shell electron.
And an outer electron drops down to fill the gap.
Exactly. Emitting an X-ray photon with an energy corresponding to that specific large energy jump between inner and outer shells, the X-ray spectrum tells you about the element.
Okay, so electrons jumping between levels is key. And that brings us neatly to lasers.
Ah, lasers. A fantastic example of quantum principles in action.
How does the quantum stuff make a laser beam?
It relies heavily on a process called stimulated emission. Normally, an excited electron will eventually drop down and emit a photon spontaneously in a random direction. But if a photon with the exact right energy comes along while the electron is still excited,
what happens?
It can stimulate the electron to drop down and emit a second photon that is perfectly identical to the first one. Same energy, same direction, same phase. An exact clone.
But so one photon becomes two identical photons. That sounds like amplification.
That's exactly what it is. Light amplification. To make it work well, you need a few things. You need a material with a suitable metastable state.
Meaning?
An excited state where electrons tend to hang out for a bit longer than usual, giving stimulated emission a better chance to happen.
Right.
Then you need to pump energy into the system using light or electricity to achieve population inversion.
Population inversion. Mm-hmm. More electrons are excited than not.
Exactly. More electrons sitting in that higher metastable state than in the lower ground state. That's the opposite of the normal situation, hence inversion.
And with population inversion, incoming photons are more likely to cause stimulated emission than be absorbed.
Precisely. So you get a chain reaction in the active medium. One photon triggers two, two trigger four, and so on. All identical.
And that gives lasers their special properties.
That's right. Because all the photons are identical clones, the light is highly coherent, all the waves are marching perfectly in step.
Which also makes it directional.
Very directional. A tight beam. And monochromatic, essentially one single color, one precise wavelength or frequency, because it corresponds to that specific energy jump. The coherence length is also very long.
Amazing. All from manipulating those quantum energy levels.
It really is. So if you kind of zoom out and connect all this back, the quantum world, yeah, it's weird. It's counterintuitive.
Definitely weird.
But it's the fundamental blueprint, isn't it? It dictates how atoms are built, how chemistry works, how light interacts with matter. And it lets us build incredible technologies like lasers, transistors, MRI machines. It's everywhere.
So thinking about what this all means for you listening, understanding these ideas like wave-particle duality, uncertainty, how observation matters. It's not just physics homework. It really does challenge how we think about certainty, prediction, and maybe reality itself.
Mm-hmm.
Which leaves us with a question maybe for you to ponder. If reality down at its most basic level is fundamentally probabilistic, inherently uncertain, and even seems to shift depending on whether or how we look at it, how might that insight change the way you approach things, how you understand complex systems or deal with uncertainty, or even just make decisions day to day?
Something to think about for sure.